I just like to sing a little bit. Thank you. Larry, please, let me play my kazoo tonight for a bit? Would you? Would you mind? No, it's over here, Larry. Would you mind if I played my kazoo? You would mind? Okay, I won't. I mean, it's all over me. I don't give a damn. One way or the other. It's like, you know, Johnny Carson comes out and he looks at Ed McMahon and says, Ed, do you mind if I do an opening monologue? And Ed says, yes, I do mind. So, okay. Sits down and says, where's the first guest then? And that would be kind of a great opening. People start booing Ed McMahon. Boo, boo. All right, I'm going to play the kazoo now, if you don't mind. Wait till I get this thing ready to go here. I just, you know, it's springtime, and I don't care what happens. There. That sounds good. All right, please, will you, Larry? 1, 2, 3, hit it. Bring it up big, big, big. I'm playing with these guys. Here we go now. Me up already. You know, I'll tell you something about the kazoo. It's an instrument that either people love or they can't stand it. They just hate it. Like so much in life. I mean, you just can't deny the fact that there's a lot in life. For example, you know, I'll tell you, I come from a long tradition of being involved in things which people basically hate. And it's not a happy thing to have to to pick this up and realize it. For example, I'm a left-handed tennis player. Well, now no left-handed tennis player's ever really made it big. No. There's a basic anti attitude towards left-handed players of all types. In fact, there has been a rumor for years that all left-handed pitchers have a very definite streak. That's right, a streak of irrationality. Let's put it this way. All left-handed pitchers are a little bit on the cuckoo bird side. Hasn't that been said many times, Walt? You agree? No basis, in fact. It's just been completely believed. Now, so I've been involved in things like this. Now, at the age of 10, I could have taken up some instrument that would have gained me instant success and fame, or at least acceptance. Nobody laughs at a party when you say you play the piano, but they do laugh at a party when you say you play the bass horn, which is what I learned to play at the age of 10. So these things they can't fail to have an effect on you. Ultimately, it's like cars, for example. I've always envied guys who like Chevys. No, I really do. No. Because they're the same people who read the Reader's Digest. They enjoy Johnny Carson. They're right in the middle of the mainstream. And they're never going to be in trouble. I mean, they really aren't. I mean, these people must be admired. At least, if not admired, at least vaguely envied by us. There are those of us who simply don't fall into that category. I mean, and I've never been able to completely accept anything totally wholeheartedly. At any point. Now, I've always admired fans of all kinds. Like, say, take rock cuckoos. Anything that's rock, they love rock totally. Well, of course, they're going to be in trouble. About 10 years, when rock is a forgotten, violent memory. It'll be rococo and remembered like Valentine's. And they're going to go the same way of the guys before them, who were insane about, say, jazz. All they thought about was jazz. Well, one day jazz slowly started to disappear, right, Larry? And where are they left? Walking around in darkness with their old records, getting increasingly boring as they talk about it. And you go all the way back on through. So I've always admired guys who've been able to, who say, I believe. There's that great ad, for example, it says, at last, something you can believe in. A Buick. Imagine a guy suddenly finds faith and trust and truth because he got his new Buick. I can just see the guy showing up at work, you know. And one of the guys says to him, say, Fred, I really envied you. I don't know what's happened to you lately. There's a quality of serenity that has entered you. Somehow, you know, you used to be a troubled man, Fred, and we've noticed lately that you're serene. You're a man who seems to have a purpose and a spine to your life. How do you do it, Fred? I bought a Buick. It's given me something to believe in. After all, a man has to believe in something, and the man has always had a hunger to believe. And I got myself an Electra. And all the other guys, the nervous-looking guys, you know, the guys that own the Volvos and the Pontiacs and, even a few guys that own 53 Studebakers, you know, who are very nervous people, are all sitting around. They envy this man who has discovered truth and beauty in his Electra. Of course, one of the sad things would be the next picture you see. You see him proceeding home on the Long Island Expressway, and all of a sudden there's a hiss and a lot of steam comes out of the hood, and it stops, and there he is standing next to his Electra. What do you do then? You've believed. Yeah. Shaky ground we're walking on, friends, all of us. Shaky ground. What do you believe in? Don't tell me you. Right, George. I've always had a secret envy of people who can walk right up, you know, when they're registering to vote, and they say, what party are you? And they say in a loud, clear voice, Democrat! Republican! I've never been part of any of those things. I've always envied people. In fact, I one time got a gift subscription. Somebody gave it to me to one of these book clubs. It was the first time I ever actually was a member of a club. Was somebody gave me a 1-year subscription to a book club, and they sent me a certificate, said I was a 1-year member of this club, and I was hoping they'd have a meeting that I could go to, you know, like the Book of the Month Club. They must have meetings someplace where they all sit around and talk about old books they read or something, you know. I don't know what it is they do with those clubs. I made one furtive effort to join a club personally myself. I was standing in a bus station in Beckley, West Virginia, as a matter of fact. It was the Greyhound station. I'm standing around there seeing there was a little poster there, and they had this little pocket, you know, with the free things. It says take one on it. So I can't help myself. I always take one wherever it says take one. So I took one, and it was an application to join the Diners Club. Well, I figured, gee, it would be kind of nice to have a, you know, be a member of a club where they dine and all that kind of stuff. You know, I've always heard about these dining clubs. They have them at Princeton, you know, these eating clubs and all. So I didn't know that they actually put out things where you could join up. So I signed up, and a couple of weeks later, I got this card. I didn't know why they asked me all these personal questions about how much money I made and, you know, whether I was in debt and all that kind of stuff. But I figured, you know, it's a very exclusive club. They'd have to know that kind of stuff, right? So I wrote in, and I got this card. And I've been waiting ever since. They have not had a meeting. I don't even know where the club rooms are. Does anyone know where the club rooms are, the Diners Club? I'm a member, but I've never been invited. I guess, well, You know, maybe I'm a second-class member. I guess some of the, you know, the guys that have been in a long time go to the meetings and all over. I must be an associate member or something. So I've always envied people who were in these clubs. Like the only time I was ever asked. See, I'm not the kind people asked to join clubs. I was in high school. And, you know, they had all these clubs. Well, I'm a freshman there, and so they don't ask freshmen. When you're first half freshman, you walk in there and you sit in your homeroom and you're not in anything yet at all. See, you just come from the Warren G. Harding School, or you come from something like that, see? And so I'm in this big high school, and I see they have all these clubs. They have a fantastic number of clubs, and they gave us this catalog, you know, the school catalog. Tells all the clubs they had. Oh, they had a lot of groovy clubs, you know, they had Cinema Club. It's kind of great. You know, they what they did was make these dirty movies, see, and that was kind of exciting. They had things like Sports Club, you know, and they got free tickets to the football games. You know, great stuff like that, see. So I was not in a club for the first 6 months. They didn't invite you until, you know, they could see that you're going to actually stay in school, because there were a lot of them fell by the wayside the first 6 months. So I made it after the first 6 months, and they had club week, where clubs invite you, and everybody's excited, you know, the club week. And I got this note in the morning, in the homeroom there. It was club week, and it was in an envelope, and it was an invitation. It says, "We invite you to join the biology club." Well, you know, it was the only one I got to join the biology club. First of all, I had no interest whatsoever in biology up to that point. I'd not taken any biology or anything. I don't know why they tagged me for the biology club, but I was invited. I'm just telling you the truth. I was invited to join the biology club. So I figured, well, what the hell? You know, any port in a storm. So that night, they had a meeting at 3:30, the first meeting, and I went to the biology club. It was held in room 102, and I walk in there, and there's a lot of girls, fat girls, sitting around. It must have been about 8 or 9, 15, 20 fat girls sitting around, and a couple of little skinny guys with very thick glasses. And there was this lady who was in charge of the club. And she was a teacher that had blue hair, and she's up there. She's pointing the way at the board, and she was talking about something called a chrysalis. And, it actually looked like a cocoon to me, or something, like a bug or something. And so I walk in, and I said, "Is this a biology club?" She said, "Yes, it is." And I said, I'm Gene Shepherd. I've got my invitation." "Oh, for heaven's sakes, we thought you were a girl. There's a girl." Well, I realized that I had been invited by mistake, and it was so embarrassing. They weren't going to ask me to stay. And I figured, though, on later thinking about it, I might have been making a mistake, because I understand later that, you know, there's a lot to biology, more than worms and stuff. I figure that maybe they got under the really good stuff, you know, when they start pulling down those shades, you know, those charts, you know, anatomy charts, so it might get pretty good. But I didn't. That was the only club I was invited to, see, so I was kind of bugged about that. And you know, have you ever had the feeling that the only thing that you ever get invited to are cockamamie organizations? You never get invited to the big one, you know. Can you imagine yourself getting inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame? No. That's right. You can't? No. That's right, you can't. I was thinking, you know, and so most of us live our lives constantly involved in the basically and totally second rate. You can't put your finger on it. So there I am, you know, in the biology club, and all the other kids are going off to the cinema club, you know, and the sports club, all those elegant clubs. And so I bided my time, see, and then at about the middle of the, possibly the middle of the second semester, I joined one other group. I finally joined the group. It was the guys who had been not invited to anything else. We began to drift around together when everybody else was having meetings, see, and they're all electing queens and preparing the programs for all the various stuff. We were all just milling around over at John's Hamburger Joint across the street. This is, by the way, the progress of an outsider. You ever heard of a rake's progress? Well, the progress of an outsider is like, you know, it just moves ahead like that, see, which reminds me, this is WOR, New York. Yes, it is. I mean, we stand up moderately clear-cut and say, yes, it is WOR, New York. We might as well not deny it. So would you please hit the button there? Oh, yeah, it's kind of nice. Now, look at that. Everybody else is advertising these big countries like Paris, like France and England. And what's Shepherd advertising? Portugal. Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Oh, yeah, it's a great little place. And I'll tell you, they have a $210 round-trip economy airfare, friends, on TAP, the Intercontinental Airline of Portugal. And you can fly to this friendly little country, walk around there with the Munchkins and the Gillikins and all the rest of them that live there in Portugal. It's kind of great. And you can visit the castle that was occupied by the actual Wicked Witch of the West. And it's all there in Portugal. And for only $210, if you're under 26 and over 12, that's the youth fare. Yeah, it's TAP's $210 youth fare to Portugal, and you can call them at 421-8500. You find out about that. And tell them you have an uncle that was a munchkin. Yeah. Hold on there. Thank you. It was real good, Larry. And we have a little note here for you here. And let's see, it's about Les Champs. It's a restaurant. It says that the commercial here begins. It says, announcer, to be read slowly, romantically. there you are at an intimate table graced by candlelight. The sounds of strolling transistorized musicians create a mellow mood as you enjoy a sumptuous dinner prepared in the continental style. And then the instruction says, louder and a little faster. No, you are not in the Parisian Café, but in the delightful Les Champs restaurant right in the heart of Manhattan on East 40th Street between the Park and Madison. At Les Champs, you'll find not only the authentic French dishes, but also an international cuisine of exotic meat and seafood entree, as well as hearty steaks and the prime tender ribs, all at moderate prices. Then it says drop voice to intimate sound as you hit, and they underline it, hit the address, Les Champs, 25 East 40th Street between Park and Madison. I repeat, Les Champs. It's a nice word to say. Try it yourself. Les Champs, 25 East 40th Street between Park and Madison.
Over the past 32 years, Newsday, the Long Island newspaper, has become one of the great success stories in publishing history. Recently, we started a Sunday edition. And what Newsday has done so well 6 days a week, we're now doing just as well on Sunday. For example, our coverage of food.
I'm Barbara Rader, food editor of Newsday. In our daily paper, we have a wide range of stories on food, including recipes and news for the food consumer. Now, on Sunday, we've added a great new element, color. Every Sunday, you'll find stories and beautiful color pictures in Newsday about the foods of Long Island. We tell you where you can buy them and how to cook them. We also show the kitchens of Long Island where they're prepared and the parties where tempting dishes are served. Sunday Newsday means we can do many new and exciting things for you in our coverage of food.
Newsday, Long Island's own Sunday newspaper. No service charge for home delivery.
All right, you Chinese food cuckoos, have you tried the Great Shanghai? Let me tell you, if you haven't, you might have missed out on some of the most fantastic Chinese food in all of New York. Very few, and I'll tell you this absolutely straight from the shoulder, very few restaurants in New York have kitchens large enough to accommodate the number of chefs from all the different regions of China that they have in the Great Shanghai. They come from Cantonese, northeastern China, Sichuan, all over the whole area there. And you can have food from all these different areas of China in the Great Shanghai. Fantastic menu. You won't believe the menu. And I would like to suggest you try the Great Shanghai Sunday brunch. It is really great. They serve it from 11 to 4 Sunday. All you can eat for $2.75. It's a buffet. And children under 4 feet tall are a buck and a half. That's the Great Shanghai, Broadway at 103rd, and there's an IRT station right there. The Great Shanghai, Broadway at 103rd Street. It is good.
Yeah, but you know, I got on this. Yeah, I'm thinking about this subject I suppose you might say herd envy. You know that there is a thing called herd envy. Have you ever heard of that in psychology? Most people think, you know, they use mostly Freudian. See, because I think we're so Freudian oriented that very few people are aware of Pavlov, who was a different type of psychologist. And he didn't deal much with that's only part of what he did, Paul, but he also dealt with a lot of other things. Like, for example, mobs. He was fascinated by mob action, by herd action, by what a large group of things would do, not just one guy laying on a couch, but a large group. And he he pinpointed a very interesting thing, which probably a lot of you have, but do not know you have it. Because very few people who write books on psychology in America write other than in the Freudian or the Jungian vein. Possibly a few Adlerians. And that is herd envy. It is a, if you can imagine a group of cows walking along on the field, see, and they're all walking along groovy. They get along great, you know. They're all chomping away at the grass, you know, and doing whatever it is cows do, and mooing and stuff, and they're all in this crowd. But for some reason or other, a couple of cows have never quite made it with the gang. So they're off fooling around by the fences, and they keep looking back over their shoulder. They'll eat grass and look like the other ones, see. But all the while, there's a vague envy of the herd. They would like to be part of that crowd. On the other hand, they begin to develop a resentment for the herd. And then they begin to develop, ultimately, a sense of inferiority, which is then quickly translated into a sense of superiority to the herd. They're too good for the herd. You know? Do you recognize any of this in yourself? Well, so, you know, it's a real problem. And I was reminded of that because today I have this gigantic almanac which is published in Europe, and it's an English almanac, one of these big thick world almanacs. See, and so today I was looking at the almanac, just picked it up. Actually, it fell on my foot. to be honest with you, I like to sound like I'm very erudite. I spend my time reading almanacs, you know, and on the phone to Gloria Steinem and all these cultural activities. But actually, what happened, I was sitting at my desk, see, and I moved my arm too quick. I've got all this stuff piled up, and this damn thing almost brained me. I'll tell you, it bounced off my shoulder and hit my left ear and slithered down and hit me on the foot. And I picked it up, and it was my almanac. Well, I dragged it up, see, to the desk. And it was covered with dust and, you know, old piccalilli from the hot dogs we get sent up from the chalk fall and all that stuff. And I dragged it up to the desk here, and I started to try to put it away, see. And it kept flopping. Oh, the book is so thick. There's some thick books that just keep, you know, get kind of squishy in the back. See, it was flopping around. And then I said, what the heck, you know. And there was a section. It has these little thumb holes, you know, where the little black things sit, where it says P through D and that kind of stuff. So the thumb hole, it says dates in history. Chronological dates. So, wonder what happened today. So I look like that. And you know what happened today? Well, a lot of important stuff happened today. But I'm not going to talk about the important stuff. Now, if I bought Chevys and believed in Buicks and read the Reader's Digest, I would talk about the important stuff. See, that's the difference. I would talk about the great Battle of Trafalgar, which began on this date. I would talk about, well, I'll tell you what happened to this on this date. The final appearance of a vaudeville act, which worked throughout the country, the final appearance was actually consummated on this date in history, roughly 55 years ago today. Now, is that important? No. But you got to know something about that vaudeville act. You know what the vaudeville act was? Are you curious? All right. Nope, this is the day to salute let's put it this way. How can we say this? The dynamic non-herd people. This is the way to salute them. Did you ever hear of an act called the Cherry Sisters? Did you know what they did? Do you know anything about them? Well, I have a fantastic little piece here about the Cherry Sisters. It came out in a magazine called the NRTA Journal. And this was some time ago, written by somebody named Judy Nelson. And she did a piece on the Cherry Sisters, and I'm saluting them tonight because this was called 55 years ago tonight, at this moment even, they were just concluding their last standing ovation before they finally packed it in for good, to the great relief of the audience. I will now read to you what the Cherry Sisters were like. A rotten tomato splattered on stage. A man in the front row tossed up a cabbage. Then an egg hurled from the balcony smashed a footlight. The singing Cherry Sisters were under siege again. The girls were furious. One stepped to the front of the stage and called out
in her shaky voice to a heckler, "You, sir, have not been raised well, or you would not interrupt a nice, respectable show." His hoarse laugh rumbled through the dance hall. An angry Jesse Cherry jumped off stage, grabbed the plank, and cracked him over the head. The crowd loved it. The man's friends doubled up with laughter. That uproarious confrontation in LaPorte City, Iowa, was only one of many that made the Cherry Sisters a theatrical legend. One of the strangest acts ever to come out of the Midwest, the Cherries could not sing, they could not dance, they could not act. Yet they were extremely prudish. Yet the prudish vaudevillians had tremendous box office wallop. Nobody has been able to explain it since. The squeaky-voiced Iowa spinsters were so incredibly bad that they were good. At the turn of the century, they were smash hits. A grateful theater manager called them the mortgage-lifting sisters. Billboards lured crowds with enticements such as, quote, "The grandest treat of the year. See the world's worst act. The laughing howl of all time." The ungainly girls with broom-handle figures were a boon to the vegetable industry. Spectators, caught up in the emotion of their ghastly act, couldn't resist throwing whatever happened to be on hand. Before the curtain was rung down on two tumultuous decades on stage, the five vegetable queens had dodged enough produce to stock the average supermarket. From towns such as Peoria, Illinois, and Osage, Iowa, came reports. It got so bad that the Cherry Sisters performed behind chicken wire screens to ward off vegetables. Now that is an act for you, man. Now the whole nation, they heard about this. See, they began to drift out into the outside world. There was such an act that was so bad that they had to work behind a screen. Now the whole nation wanted to see these peculiar entertainers. They played Wisconsin extensively, including several shows at the Fox River Valley. Fun-loving crowds at gas-lit opera halls razzed the girls unmercifully. Dignity and decorum, obviously, were qualities their act did not inspire. There was something they did up there that made even the most straight people go ape, start throwing stuff. Dressed in the homemade red calico dresses, the Dowdy sisters sang at the top of their voices, trembling with obvious real effort as the pianist scrambled to find the right key. They were not a gimmick, remember. No, that's where you're wrong if you think this is a gimmick, Larry. These people were not, and that's what made them so so controversial. They thought they were great. Then they would switch to their famous marching routine. As they hammered the bass drum, they played cymbals. The boos and catcalls shook the rafters for blocks around. By the close of the century, the old maids from the Midwestern farm were a household word from California to Maine and even around the world. Children sang their theme song, "Cherries ripe, cherries red, cherry sisters still ahead, ta-ra-ra-bum-ti-hey, cherry sisters are here to stay." That was their theme song. I do it quite well, don't I? Hammy, overdramatic, and devoid totally of talent, the Cherries were hilarious all the way from the Corn Belt to Broadway. And they finally came to New York and hit it big. And this was back before the turn of the century, man, when $15 was a lot of money. The Cherry Sisters, each one of them, earned $1,000 a week. All right, the sisters, Ella, Effie, great names. Listen, Ella, Effie, Lizzie, Addie, and Jesse had been orphaned as teenagers. Their father left them a 20-acre farm at Marion, a ramshackle house, and a few dairy farms, cows. The girls dreamed up their act in 1893 as a way of paying off the mortgage. More as a lark, they rented a hall in Marion, the town where they lived, for $5, and invited their friends to see what would be their first taste of showbiz. It thrilled them. The stage offered an exciting diversion from the farms, sunrise to sunset tedium, and it gave them a platform for moral crusading. They laced their recitations and melodramas, such as The Gypsy's Warning, with dire predictions about the evils of drink, the evils of smoking, social dancing, and smooth-talking swains. Well, despite the nightly howls, the sisters remained chipper. After a tomato barrage in Chicago, this is what Effie told a reporter. "Well, they were just ignorant. and they didn't appreciate the kind of entertainment that the best people enjoy. You're always apt to run into some ignorant people in the theater.
Now, that takes guts. I mean, you got to hand it to them. Later, when an outraged audience gave vent to its feelings, the plump, red-cheeked Addie stepped to the footlights, and she barked, "If you don't keep quiet, we're going to ring down the curtain. We ain't desirous of singing here tonight, no how."
Well, when it came to audience participation, the cherries couldn't be matched. An amazed reporter, this is an actual quote from one of the papers that saw them work, reported, he says, "Imagine 200 leading citizens leaping to their feet, waving hats, umbrellas, brooms, and handkerchiefs, reaching toward the stage and shouting themselves hoarse in mock approval." Said the Cherry Sisters' shows were always chock full of action. Boy, would they make it big today. They would cut Tiny Tim going away.
Hey, you know, speaking of that, well, there's always two or three curio acts that are playing around. You know, that's one of those curio things in showbiz. What was that plump sort of middle-aged lady that would sing and play the piano that was big for a while, Mrs. Something? Mrs. Miller, that's right. Well, she was a Cherry Sister of our time, you know. She, "Oh, red sails in the sunset, oh, dee-dee-dee-dee." But can you imagine the Cherry Sisters? But anyway, they finally packed it in, and their last performance was on this date. And they're still, the word is still around, you know, still a phrase that is used. People say, "My God, that's a real Cherry Sisters act." And nobody knows really what it was like. But these people were so incredibly bad that they became a fantastic world celebrity. Well, now, by the way, one of them died in 1944, the last one, the one that was, the last surviving member of the crowd. And they, to their last days, did not feel that they were bad. They just felt that the world didn't appreciate true dignity, didn't appreciate taste. Now, I listen, don't laugh. I'll tell you, I had a funny thing happen to me one time. This reminded me of something. A few years ago, I was in a review, and the review was a review. And it was by a review. You know what a review is as opposed to a one-man show. A review is a number of performers and acts that all work together, and then they do their specialties and so forth. And this review was done in New York. It was a really, really a sensational, it was a good review. It's by sensational, I mean it was beautifully produced. And it was in a small, chic nightclub here in New York. See, when I first came to New York, I did a lot of review stuff and a lot of acting and Broadway things. And I was in this review. Well, on our first night when we were rehearsing, there was one act that I couldn't believe. It was unbelievably bad. Fantastic. Well, I thought it was kind of a, you know, it was kind of a satire. I figured it was a satire. It was just really a turkey, really bad. So I didn't say anything. This guy did his thing saying, and afterwards, I went out to dinner with the producers. See, I've signed the contract and I'm sitting with them. I had to bring it up. See, now finally says, "Hey, what about the, you know, Fred and his ding dong birds? That's kind of, you know, kind of a strange act." And he says, "Hey, listen, shh." He says, "He thinks he's great." He says, "Don't say anything about it. For heaven's sakes, that ain't a satire. He thinks he's fantastic." Well, that night, when we first opened, I was afraid. See, I thought, "Oh, this guy's going to get, you know, he's going to get harpooned, man. The critics are really going to tear this guy apart." So we started to perform. We did the show, and the show went really great. And it got good reviews, by the way. It went real fine, and I could hardly wait to see the next week to find out what the reviewers. When the reviewers came out the weekend, we performed our opening show. It was on a Saturday night. Papers came out Sunday, Monday morning. I wanted to see what they'd say. To a man, they gave this guy great reviews because they thought he was doing a beautiful tongue-in-cheek parody of bad acts. And he came in the next night, see, with these reviews that said how great he was, this wonderful tongue-in-cheek parody of a really rotten act. It was a really great bit. And he was stunned. He said, "What are these? What do they mean? What is this?" Yeah, well, you know, critics, they don't understand anything. You know, after all, old Fred, you know, your ding-dong act is terrific, you know. Everybody knows that. It gets those laughs that night. Well, I began to see that a lot of people that we think are performing a satire, or, you know, a put-on, are really not at all. They're serious. In fact, one of the great lessons I had, I suppose I shouldn't talk out of the trade. There's a lot of things that people in the theater don't even talk much about because it can be embarrassing. But a few years ago, there was a show that was playing downtown on 2nd Avenue. And I happened to have been doing a show in the same theater the week before. It was a limited run, and we were closing on, say, like on a Saturday night, and they were bringing in all their stuff, their sets. This new show was going to begin rehearsal the following Monday, and 2 weeks later they were going to open. See? So a friend of mine who owned the theater, it was a funny little scene. About Tuesday morning after we had closed, he called me up and says, "Come on over." He says, "You won't believe it." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "My God." He says, "I'm not going to say anything." He says, "You won't believe it. Will you get over here?" I says, "What is it?" He says, "The show to come in." He says, "It's fantastic." He says, "One of the worst things I ever saw. It's incredible." So I said, "Sure, I'll come over." So I went over to the theater, and here they were all up there in their costumes, and they're dancing around at camp. You know, the music is playing. And they're playing. I said, "Oh, no." And I couldn't help myself but laugh. I was laughing. I know, and they were up there performing. I was laughing. And so we went out to dinner, and he says, "You know, the sad thing about it," he says, "this guy has put all his dough in his show, this guy that wrote this thing and that put it all together." And he says, "He really believes it's a fantastic show. It's a great show. So he really believes in this." He says, "You know, what can you do? See, he's got to get it out of his system." Well, the thing to remember about this story is that these people were absolutely serious about this show. They were not being funny at any point. They were very serious about it. So the night that it opened, everybody around the theater figured, you know, the guys that ran the theater, I'm talking about the pros, figured, "Oh, boy, this is going to be a scalping like the world has never seen." Well, the curious thing happened. The show opened. The audience was filled with people. Well, the people in the audience had the same reaction I did. They couldn't help laughing. They couldn't help really laughing at this show. They laughed at it. Well, it was very funny. And the next day, the reviews were raves. And they said it's a fantastic satire of musicals. They said it was a wonderful takeoff on musicals. And they really made a whole big thing about what a fantastic takeoff and a satire it was on musicals. But to the people who were inside the theater, you know, who knew the whole production, they weren't trying to satirize anything. They just produced a musical that was so rotten that it became a satire of bad musicals. And it was accepted as that, and everybody connected with the production became famous as being great satirists. The sad thing, of course, is that they've never been able to repeat it, because that was something you can, in other words, when they tried to do satire, they couldn't do it, because being a satirist is a whole profession in itself. Doing a bad musical is something else. And so I've often wondered how many reputations are based on a complete misreading of what the guy was doing. And he became famous for something he didn't think he was famous for. And then, of course, afterwards began to go along with it and proceed to play on that reputation. And so tonight, the Cherry Sisters. I'd love to have seen them. Although, actually, there are a lot of acts like that. I remember one time being at a rock concert. It was a very funny scene, you know. These behind-the-scene things about various... You know, many rock groups, have become very big commercial commodities. I mean, they can really make a lot of dough being, you know, having a rock group. Well, it's very important that a rock group look a certain way. No rock group, for example, is four short little fat guys. You notice that? No way. Rock groups all have to look alike. So record companies a few years ago began to realize that.
And they went out and they got guys who were just plain actors. They were not the performers or musicians of any type. And they went out and they got actors and put them on the cover of albums. And here you saw this rock group, you know, the Great Disaster rock group. And here they all looked a little bit like Jesus Christ crossed with possibly Buddha. You know, a little touch of Oriental mysticism, you know. And they're all standing there looking out of the darkness. And you play the rock, you play the record, gee, it sounds fantastic. See, what they didn't say was the guys on the cover didn't play the stuff that's on the LP. They went out and they got some really professional studio musicians and, you know, great arrangers, and they turned out this stuff. Well, they build a rock act completely on record. And they're never seen, see? So then finally they make their big appearance on a big TV show. Well, they don't play that. They meme it. And they put the record that was cut by the studio people on the audio system, and that's what the crowd hears. Well, I was with a group one time in a, it was a very interesting scene. I was with a group in a big rock concert, very famous group. And they never play. You know, many rock groups don't even play at their concerts. They just play a tape backstage, and it comes out of the speakers. And they just up there, you know, play like they're playing the guitars, and everybody's screaming. Nobody cares. They're yelling and hollering anyway. See, they don't really hear what's going on. So they're up there memeing it away, see. So this rock group comes backstage, and we're sitting around talking, and a kid comes in, somebody from some music magazine. He wanted to ask this one guy on how he played various things on the guitar. He says, could you give me his... The guy couldn't play the guitar. He was the lead guitar player. So he just carried the guitar. He knew how to carry it. See, real good. And it looked great and fantastic. You know, it looked a little bit like possibly a cross between William Jennings Bryan and General Custer, with a little touch of a Sioux Indian chief thrown in there for good measure. See, fantastic looks. They made millions and millions of dollars, and they were just a paid act to front the LP, the tapes. So, and they later, by the way, broke up, and there was great crying in the rock world when they broke up, and everybody assumed these great talents had left the scene. and of course, the actual guys that played this stuff were still playing down at the Pit Band at the Radio City. But the flim-flammery that goes on in show business often is a curious problem with people who are in the business. In other words, a guy who's a real performer, he doesn't know what to do when he's confronted with somebody who doesn't even play the guitar and is called a famous guitar player, and then, by the way, goes on to win all the national awards as guitar players. You know, by the way, that rock group, very interestingly enough, the one I'm talking about, the lead guitar player won 2 national awards as a guitarist. And he couldn't play the damn thing. So you can't really put down the Cherry Sisters. Not really, ultimately. At least they did their own croaking when they got out on the stage. You know, they actually sang their own theme song, which is what made them famous. You know, cherries ripe, cherries red, Cherry Sisters still ahead. Cherry Sisters here to stay. And that's an actual lyric of one of the songs they sang. And so this has been a historic day. Cherry Sisters packed it in on this day. The last grapefruit, the last cantaloupe bounced off the stage, and they finally left to the great, great rest. And I've always admired guys who believe in Chevy seriously. Oh, yeah. Those cows that walk on the other side of the herd. It's like my old man. He believed in Oldsmobiles the way other people believed in, the fundamental Baptist rites. Oh, yes. Wake my old man up at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, what are you? And he said, I'm an Olds man, Oldsmobiles. And so, each one. There are Rheingold men. There are, you know, oh, sure. Everybody judges himself by what he eats, by what he drinks, by what he buys. Oh, yes. They're Playboy readers. It's a new religion. They're Village Voice readers. They think of themselves as a special little group going through life. They belong to this little crowd. And so it's kind of nice, I suppose, looking up into the vast hammock of time when that slow swinging moon moves overhead and the scudding clouds play upon the blue vastness of the solar system. It's kind of nice to know where you stand.
Yep, I believe in my Buick. By God. By God, I do.
This is WOR New York. Stay tuned for Lester Smith and the news.
This is the news in detail on the hour from the WOR newsroom. Looking for a gambler who told about horse race fixing is the office of Queens District Attorney Thomas Mackle. The wanted man is Bobby Byrne, who testified on Tuesday with bodyguards standing by and behind a pair of sunglasses, telling a congressional committee about how horses were drugged to make them lose to undrugged horses. Among the tracks that Byrne had testified about before the House Crime Committee was Aqueduct and the Queens District Attorney wants a transcript of Byrne's testimony plus some hard evidence, if there is any, about the alleged race fixing at the Big A. Japan Airlines reports 10 Americans were among the 83 persons killed in last night's crash of a Japan Airlines plane near New Delhi, India. In all, people of 11 nationalities were aboard the aircraft when it crashed and burned. There were only 6 survivors. The flight was due to stop at New Delhi while en route from Tokyo to London. Guilty on 3 counts of lying to a federal grand jury was the verdict late today in the trial of former Manhattan Republican official Joseph Ruggiero. He faces a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment, a $10,000 fine. The grand jury that Ruggiero was convicted of giving false testimony to was investigating alleged corruption. Ruggiero is a former chairman of the New York County Republican Law Committee. He was once a counsel to the State Racing Commission. China Times again for Dr. Henry Kissinger. White House announcement today said the president's foreign affairs advisor would go to mainland China later this week for still another session of conferences with China's leaders. And according to White House spokesman Ron Ziegler, Dr. Kissinger plans no side trips to any other nations, nor will he meet with representatives of other governments other than China's while in Peking. And while Dr. Kissinger goes to China, the Soviet Union will have a top man in North Vietnam. Newsman Chris Ogden reports from Moscow on why a trip to Hanoi is being made at this time by the Kremlin official.
President Nikolai Podgorny's trip to Hanoi may well be the first step in a new Soviet effort to mediate a peace in the Vietnam War. That's what communist sources are hinting here in Moscow. They're also calling it an attempt to counter suspected Chinese pressure on Hanoi to time its spring offensive to undermine the Nixon summit. Nixon's talks with the Soviet leadership highly displeased Hanoi, according to the communists. Neither side apparently changed its position on who it was backing in Vietnam, but Russia's fairly mild rebuke of the mining of North Vietnam's ports and the intensified U.S. bombing did nothing to add to Hanoi's confidence in its Kremlin allies. It's the embarrassing task of patching up that confidence that most likely awaits Podgorny in Hanoi. Chris Ogden in Moscow.
And we'll have more news after this.
The New York Bank for Savings depositors are getting additional increases in effective annual...